So let me start us off. Hello, and welcome to the Declined Estate Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Declined Estate is proud to bring you one of the surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. If at any point you would like to call and weigh in on the conversation, please contact Skype user Declined Estate with a text message, and we'll do our best to get you on the air. If you're interested, we may keep you on. That's Declined Estate spelled out one word and with no punctuation. You can now find us on the web at our official website, declinefm.com, and there you will find a link to a brand new live chat, which we're all on now, so head on in. And if there's a topic you want to hear discussed on the show or a later show, please submit to r/declinedestate@reddit.com. And links to both our live stream and archived episodes can be found at both DeclineFM and r/declinedestate@reddit.com. I'm host Ronald McPaul, and I think I'm going to do it. I'm going to use this day to declare independence from the United States of America. I'm joined by my handsome and at least one lovely co-casters, and I'm going to let them go around the horn and introduce themselves.
Hi, it's Eternal.
Hey, it's Nintendo.
Hello, guys. This is Rotto here. Welcome to our show. I hope you have a great time listening to us.
And I'm Shiny. Welcome to Decline to Save.
All right, guys. So today is not like any other day. Today is the 4th of July, which means less for Nintendo down in Australia than it does for some of the rest of us. But let's talk about what this day means and perhaps what I feel like is kind of the underpinning irony of this day. I have the Declaration of Independence, the full text up in front of me right now, and I'm struck by the words, and I quote, "A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation." And I don't know, what do you guys think? Do you feel like we have a decent respect to the opinions of mankind? I think I know what the answer might be.
Yeah, I'm gonna say no.
Yeah, you know, I think it's fairly obvious where I stand on that one.
So you're saying as a Commonwealth person, still attached to the king and queen. Not much respected.
No, I wouldn't. Those are not the words I would choose personally.
So maybe it's fair that we can separate ourselves. I heard Shiny earlier. You mentioned that it's the what did you call the declaration today? In other words, you called it the Declaration of Dependence.
Oh, yes. Declaration of Dependence. Happy National Dependence Day, guys.
Yeah. What is it like?
We have come to depend on a fully different nation than we used to.
You guys have really come far. You guys have really come far.
Aren't you proud of us?
I just think it's pretty ironic that we threw a revolution to protest. It was like a 2% tax on tea or something. Like, that's what spawned the whole thing.
And nowadays,
50% is what everyone pays. I mean, it's absolutely kind of silly.
if we can even figure out the math, that is.
Yeah, I don't even... It's mind-boggling.
So that being said, I mean, we're getting over the formalities in terms of what marks the occasion. If you hear any fireworks, it's most likely not gunshots, but I know Eternal's in D.C., so it could be gunshots rather than fireworks.
I'm in Virginia, so I'm
close.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah. That was toasty time.
This is America, after all, so if you hear gunshots, you understand why, right?
Try to distinguish them from fireworks. But let's go to real news, or stuff that actually is perhaps more interesting, is a discovery that happened very recently, or more a confirmation of one, but over at the CERN laboratory in Switzerland, on the border of Switzerland and and France, I think you guys know where I'm going with this, is the Higgs boson was confirmed.
Yeah, so earlier, I guess it was today, we found out that they released confirmation of the Higgs boson, which is the what I guess the media called the God particle for reasons unbeknownst to those of us who actually are scientists. Yeah. It's within 5 sigma, which means, you know, really, really quite likely. It's a good confirmation that it does in fact exist. And the real question is, you know, why is this important? Because obviously people have been talking about this for many years now. We built, you know, what's this, the $10 billion or something? It's a ridiculous amount of money they spent on the Large Hadron Collider over in CERN. And just to find this thing, pretty much. I mean, granted, do other stuff, but this was the big thing they were after.
Yeah.
So, you know, why is it so important? And it comes down to something, like, for those of you who are familiar with the physics, this will seem a little elementary, but you have your Einsteinian physics, which is, you know, relativity, special and general relativity, and then you got quantum mechanics. So special relativity and general relativity deal with really fast things, really big things. I'm talking about gravity and warping of space-time and all that good stuff. Quantum mechanics has to deal with the very small. It has to do with stuff down at the atomic and subatomic level. So, you know, what the heck do those two things have to do with each other? Well, when you deal with really small-scale stuff, but, you know, you have a lot of mass, like, you know, something like stars and whatnot, there's quantum effects, and then there's gravity involved, and they don't play nice with each other. So, there's this whole quantum gravity theory that's been going around called string theory. It's been in the works for, I don't know, 40 years or so. And it rests pretty heavily on this concept called supersymmetry. And supersymmetry is one of those bizarre physics terms. It basically means particles have big, large cousins. So our regular guys, like electrons and protons that we're all familiar with, well, they got big, large, supersymmetric cousins that are hundreds or thousands of times bigger than they are. The Higgs boson is something which helps prove that supersymmetry. And you know, being able to see it is a good confirmation that we're on the right path. And it basically, you know, verifies the physics that have been going on for the last 30, 40 years. Because you know, it's gotten to the point where physics is pretty much all theoretical math. And it's good to see some concrete evidence for things. It doesn't happen very often.
And I'm impressed, to say the least, by kind of the depth of your knowledge. I've gone through that stuff before, but I don't have it at the tip of my tongue. When you were referring to the 5 sigma, obviously you're getting at the fact that it's the 5 sigma refers to the 5 standard deviations. So if you're looking at this statistically, that's how far it is away from the average, or that's how kind of describes how unlikely it is that this was just a random coincidence. And putting that 5 sigma in the layman's terms, that's like 99 point something, you know, way in there percent. So pretty, you know, like you said, a pretty good confirmation that this is what they found.
Yep.
Yeah, 5 sigma would be about 99.9999% confident that this observation is not an anomaly.
It's pretty confident.
That's how sure I am that I want to declare independence from the state.
Oh, come on, you're a bit surer than that.
5 sigma independent. We should rename the day. And then Higgs was named after. I mean, Higgs was the name of the physicist. And like you said, I guess Peter Higgs. I got the website up now, or got Wikipedia. He theorized. From my knowledge, the Higgs field, and which is the idea that there's like a field which enacts on particles, which I guess is these Higgs boson, which is what's responsible for giving things mass. I think in the precast, Shiny was talking about if you were to give it a TLDR or a short summary, the Higgs boson is what gives things mass.
Except in for a Americans. Sense. That's high for just 0.0. So we'll be different physics over here.
So somebody tweeted me this description of what the Higgs field is. Particles wading through the field gain heft the way a bill going through Congress attracts riders and amendments.
Wait, say that one more time?
That's awesome.
Particles making their way through the Higgs field gain heft, gain mass. The way a bill going through Congress attracts riders and amendments.
That is so perfect for the 4th of July.
I think that's probably the best analogy I've ever had for the Higgs field. That's great. Fantastic. That's good stuff. Yeah, I think I'm kind of a physics buff, so yeah, this stuff actually has a lot of meaning to me, particularly as I follow science. And it's really wonderful to finally see something happen, because quite frankly, you haven't really found a whole lot of new stuff with physics for a while. I mean, it's mostly been a lot of theorizing and a lot of math.
Well, and they did have that troll discovery that things can go faster than light.
Yeah, that was turned out to be an equipment fault.
Because, right.
Yeah, of course it was. That's not as interesting, though. You don't get media attention with that.
Right, yeah. But it is interesting that it kind of causes society at large to follow along with the scientific method, which is a rare, if ever, thing you get that to occur.
Yeah, that's nice.
I think that one was particularly a great show for the scientific method, because the focus was on how can we come up with a reasonable explanation for why we got this, other than, oh my god, it was a miracle, our model is completely wrong.
Yeah, the wheels really start turning. I had my roommate at the time was actually a astronomy PhD who was working at NASA, working for Neil deGrasse Tyson. Not really, I don't think. But I kind of asked him, and he said he was skeptical. I guess like probably eternal would be, or like all of us would be, who are following the science. It's so new. This news is I mean, I knew that that's what the CERN was, and I knew CERN was really exciting when it got introduced, and this was the main goal, like you said. I don't know how I feel about it. It's kind of, I mean, yeah, it's a huge discovery, and I guess.
Yeah, one of the questions I, of course, have are, like, would this stuff occur in the market? I mean, do you think there's enough of an interest? Do you think people care about this enough that they would, you know, throw, like, $50... to some project that would look at these very kind of abstract theoretical physics experiments.
Yeah, and so what you're saying is, I mean, not that would Higgs bosons occur, because I think we're sure that would occur in both cases. But what you mean, would this research? I mean, based that CERN, CERN research laboratory, which costs what $10 million or so, $10 billion to make, would that have occurred, right? And yeah, it's hard to say. My thought was that if you have a market for things, most people's thought is that there's got to be a direct application for that technology to be developed somewhere down the road, some way for people to profit off it, rather than just pure scientific inquiry and glee. But certainly if it was the latter case, if people just wanted to find stuff out, people are free to donate, but could they get that $10 billion mark?
The LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, which is not, it's one of the projects at CERN, has a lot of business sponsors. I'm actually looking at an index of them, a lot of things on here. Intel, Oracle, IEEE, Siemens, Sun, WD, Dell.
That's cool.
Yeah, I wasn't aware. What do you think their interest is? You just probably, I guess it could just be good advertising for their companies to say that they're
advertising R and maybe it's a kind of a long shot R&D type thing. And like, well, we'll just support science because I don't know. It could work out. Science could give us stuff back. It's been known to do that, but from time to time.
The companies that are especially companies dealing with technology at a very small scale have a vested interest in the standard model of physics either working out or being replaced, because it determines what products they can actually create.
Well, certainly, I know microprocessors today are designed, and like hard drives and stuff, they take advantage of quantum tunneling. I mean, they have to understand that kind of quantum effects, because what happens is you have energy leakage out of your transistors and stuff. It's really a mess.
Wow.
That's not my area of expertise, but
well, you
I know
are,
a little bit about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a nerd too. I studied bioengineering. I know you're working as an electrical engineer now, and that's what you went to school for, right? Go into that a little bit more. You said that they have to take that stuff into account, just because of the scale is so small, right? And you were talking earlier.
You're talking about the nanoscale. I mean, you know how small the cores are on just your standard CPUs that go in your computer now, like your regular old PC. I mean, you're talking about like 45 nanometer is pretty much run of the mill, and they're working on I think 28 is the new core size.
Wow. Yeah, I know they're getting smaller and smaller.
It's crazy. How many and you have to fit all those, transistors and then logic gates on down there. So I mean, it's absolutely nuts how small they have to make things. Well, when you get things that small, I mean, you're talking about you can count the molecules. It's pretty damn small.
I
and
wonder.
You have weird quantum effects go on. So. Gotta understand quantum mechanics.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of new computers they'll come out for us.
Quantum computers.
Are those things you think that would be stable enough to get into to phones or stuff for home use, or I guess?
Oh, I actually just saw there's an article on Ars Science. Let me pull it back up really quick. This is really interesting stuff. Hold on 1 second.
Yeah.
Room temperature quantum bit created. This is from TG Daily. I had to skim through it, but it turns out that when you do quantum computing, you have to create things called quantum bits or qubits, which store information at the quantum level. And that enables you, like, you know, a regular bit is like 0 or 1? Like, it's on or off, binary.
Yeah.
Well, quantum bit can be 0 or 1 or anything in between. It allows you to create what is called a superposition of 0 and 1, so it's just a weighted average. So,
it'd
be
so
like 60%
more...
1, 40% 0.
Right, and so what you're talking about, too, is computers use binary, obviously. That's what you're referring to with 1 or 0. We, in most cultures, in common parlance, we use base 10. If with those qubits, if there's different states, do they have... Would there be computers, that's what you're referring to, with quantum computers that would have a different base system or kind of a...
It's completely different. I know almost nothing about this, but I do know that the way they solve problems is not the same way that... It's not completely deterministic. It's just a different way of programming entirely. Johnny, you were going to say?
It's hard to actually summarize in a non-technical way, but I'll give you a little bit from what I know. So if you're, say, you're trying to crack some encryption key, and, maybe you've got 8 letters. This is a very weak key. You've got 8 letters, which you're trying to guess. So on a typical non-quantum computer, you have to guess, 8 to the power or, 26 to the power of 8 combinations in order to figure out the key. So you've got to try the first one, then the second one so far, go through them serially. I mean, you can look for them in parallel if you've got several processors, but essentially you have to march through every possible combination. So the idea is in a quantum computer, you would basically be testing all of them at the same time. The memory storing or the registers storing these bits are actually storing a combination of 1 and 0 at one point in time. I know this sounds very weird, but... Essentially, you perform this calculation that would take exponential time in polynomial time due to each bit being able to occupy a superposition of states.
Wait a minute, what is the difference between polynomial time and the other time?
So exponential means, if the amount of time it takes to check one combination is x, you may have to check, in this case, 26 to the x combinations, whereas polynomial time is more x to a certain power. I don't actually know what the power is, but in terms of large numbers of possible combinations, it makes a difference of whether the problem is actually tractable or whether it's not.
Wow, that is crazy. I'm gonna have to re-listen to this because I think you've blown a few of our brains.
Yeah. I would say so.
It is pretty mind-blowing, including, theoretically, if we could build this quantum computer, it would break all existing encryption schemes completely.
Would that break Bitcoin too?
That is a great question.
How do you, can I ask, is this a side interest, or how did you learn about that? Was this, not to say that any of us are ever at work and we browse the internet, or, but what kind of led you to explore or get to know about the polynomial time or the background of that?
I actually was very interested in quantum physics when I was in high school, and I read it a lot on my own time. In terms of the complexity theory, I had to study that when I was studying in college. I ended up not graduating, but I thought I was going to. Had to study, and it turns out to be pretty fascinating.
Very cool.
I had a question. So, with quantum computing, it seems kind of like if we ever get there, that as far as packing more power into a smaller amount of space, there might be a bit of a roof reach, but I'm probably just not understanding it correctly. So what kind of, like, if we discovered quantum computing tomorrow in a practical application at a consumer level, what kind of scalability would you see in terms of power, computing power, do you think?
It's not so much, it's not even a computing power thing as far as I can tell. Like, it's something just completely different. It's like a new dimension to the way you solve computer problems. It's not even comparable. It's not on the same plane.
Wow, okay.
The whole study of computability sort of divides problems into those that are generally tractable, P class of problems, versus non-polynomial or basically intractable problems, NP. If we were able to solve NP problems in a reasonable amount of time, it would completely change the whole foundation of how we study computer science. This classification would no longer be practically meaningful.
Wow.
It breaks math. Okay.
So it's a completely different paradigm.
Yeah, it breaks things. Supposedly. I'm not entirely sure how it works. I know that there are quantum computers in existence. They are gigantic and have to be super cooled and cost millions and millions of dollars. I don't know how they work either.
They're
experimental.
How many bitcoins will you get per hour with one?
You could break Bitcoin. It's very well possible.
There was actually something to that comment that Reto had.
That's why I don't own bitcoins. I'm like a psychic. I totally foresee this happening.
I realized on the first show too that you were psychic, because we were talking about markets. I'm gonna have to heed your financial advice more frequently.
Don't buy things if you don't have money for it.
Oh my god, you are a psychic.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good advice, right?
Extraordinary. Extraordinary.
Too bad the government doesn't listen to it.
What?
Yeah.
It's going to be pretty difficult not to talk about tech stuff the whole time now. My interest has seriously been piqued.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly think that, you know, we'll see. You know, if quantum computing becomes a big thing, I mean, if it reaches the, you know, a consumer level, as you say, it breaks so many things that it would seriously upset, you know, things like the governmental power. And you know, bank security and all sorts of stuff we take. Yeah. God forbid what happens.
Because
goes to hell.
Because what you're talking about is so much of our security just relies on things being just very, very difficult to solve, or problems are very unlikely to get, you know, going back to that Five Sigma, you know, way beyond. But with this, you can just brute force attack anything. Essentially, if you have this multi, you know, many levels, orders of magnitude, higher order processing power, you just, it's like driving a truck through a schoolyard. And that's the last time I try to get into computer analogies.
Yeah. It just sounds like a whole different world that doesn't even, yeah, mind-blowing.
If we were to move away from computer topics, if the group will allow it a little bit, one general topic, and I think because we're a group from oh, it looks like we might have a caller actually.
We do actually have a caller, and I'm gonna patch him through. Hello, this guy identifies himself on Skype as Psy Every Day.
Mr. Psy Every Day.
Welcome. Can you hear us?
Psy, can you hear us? You're a very, very well-known Reddit user.
I'm hearing nothing out of him.
I think the static is him trying to talk.
Yeah, I think his mic's messed up or something.
Oh, okay. Bear with us, guys. This is our first official Skype call-in on the show, so we're working through it, and, you know, most likely it's not on our end. We've kind of tested things out.
No, I think we lost him.
He was lagging out every day. Well, that's too bad. I'm sure he had something to add on Higgs bosons.
Well, maybe he can try every day until he gets through.
Uh-huh.
Or he could use the IRC chat, perhaps, if he's got something to say.
Yeah, that would be very nice. If he wants to join us, he can join us through the chat, and somebody here can post what he says.
Psy Every Day, for the listeners' reference, is, you know, as a community of Reddit users, he's a well-known one. Not to say that he's, you know, in any bad way, but has shifted views, so it'd be a good discussion. He's not a contrarian, perhaps, as much as he's kind of shifted from maybe more from our ANCAP point of view to an ANCOM point of view. So, you know, dissenting views are always welcome, I guess, is what's important to know. I'm being told by the chat not ANCOM but more mutualist, so we should be precise.
Right, Ronald, our caller seems to have interrupted something that you were going to say. Care to continue?
Oh, yeah. I was going to, thanks for keeping us on track. I was going to switch topics. One thing, and I think, Reddo, you will find very close to your heart as our resident debate expert, is going down the rabbit hole with people. We know, you know, Psy Every Day, who just tried to call in, has a differing point of views on things. You know, what kind of sparked this is, I think, as a group, we had a link to r Colorado, of all subreddits. And we head in there, and you know, you're some people who are kind of familiar with our views or might be a good talking point, and kind of the subject came up, was going down the rabbit hole with people, introducing them to our point of view, our views, on non-aggression, on you know, peaceful living, the libertarian point of view, and kind of that arc you make when you're introducing somebody to things and bringing them into, you know, how you view the world and letting them know. And I kind of want to go down the arc of, you know, what that looks like. I don't know if you were in on that one, Reddo, but on the end of this one, we ended up kind of realizing we weren't making much progress. And we had to just go back to defining our terms and saying, you know, are we talking about the same thing? Because, you know, when you're not making any progress, it sounds like you have to at least have a starting point where you're talking about the same thing.
You know what? You're right. If I recall correctly, we ended up having to fall back to defining our terms, which is always disheartening, because you, at the point that you have to do that, it's, you've invested a significant amount of time talking with the guy, right? And then with that means is everything that you said, he actually has to reinterpret, if he has the patience to reinterpret, and if not, it doesn't really matter. But it was clear that you weren't communicating, and that can be so frustrating.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, these debates on Reddit, they're not like normal in real life debates, or IRL debates, as we call them. It's you know, this happens in kind of, you know, breaks at work or times, you know, your downtime as you're going to bed on your phone, just, you know, you're kind of seeing this person through, you know, and you don't know who this person is, but you still have this, you know, this most, you know, deep down hope that you can share your view. You want to, you know, get these positive messages out. And when it, yeah, just like you said, it's frustrating when you get to some point and you realize, oh, we're not even talking about the same thing. With this guy in particular, not to bash some random Reddit user, but it, you know, it kind of felt like the way he was using words were mimicry. And I know that, you know, we've all seen a lot of your debate threads, and I think you've probably had more success than I have, but I at least just wanted to take him to the point where I said, these are the implications of what you're saying. I want to say it's wrong, you know, right or wrong, but you know what the state is it's a, you know, it's a territorial monopoly on aggressive force or on force. And I mean, I just want to pose a question to the person. Are you okay with that?
You make me think of something that I usually encounter when debating with somebody or even having a simple conversation that is completely non-debate in nature. And that is, I tell them, you know, well, let's go back to definitions. The state is a territorial monopoly on the use of violence. They are the only people who are allowed to use violence. And suddenly they flip something in their brain. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but if you can clearly tell, they just flip something. And then they say something like, oh, we have another caller. Well, we'll take you, caller. We'll take you in a minute. What I'm trying to say is, think about it. The person who's talking to you snaps out of the conversation. And in snapping out of the conversation, he says, no, the state is not that. You see, we get together and we choose a state because the state, we as a society, and then they begin this, you know, enter this magical soup of words or world of words where nothing actually has a meaning, a defined meaning, and then they reinterpret the state to be something that has nothing to do with the state, right? They could define the state to be something like a company or like a mutualist association or something like that, which is really weird.
All right, yeah. So let's go to our caller, I guess. Let's do that. So who do we have calling in?
All right.
Hello, caller.
Hello, caller.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
Awesome. All right.
We
What's
can
up,
hear you loud
guys?
And clear.
Ooh.
I wouldn't say clear.
Would not say clear.
You're distorting a little bit, but we can hear you. Just try to make sure you don't get too close to the mic, and we'll let you know as we go along. You care to introduce yourself?
All right. Yes, my Skype name is Cy Eriday, but unfortunately for all of you, that is not actually my Reddit name.
Well, it was a good troll because
my Reddit.
We gave a full introduction to Cy Eriday in case you called back.
Yeah, I think my problem was I had the show running in the background and it was using all my upload bandwidth or something. Anyway, I'm Patrick Four Fives. You might know me on the ANCAP
forums. I do recognize that name. I positive associations, if I remember correctly. How's it going?
Welcome to our show, Patrick.
It's going pretty good. Yes, thank you. I called in because you guys were talking about technology and Bitcoin. And I would like to talk about a website, judge.me. It's a private arbitration, and I've never used it, but I wanted to know your thoughts on it and if any of you have used it and have good things to say.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the topic you bring up, and it's okay, I guess, if we jump around. I know we're jumping around on like discussing debate stuff, but for callers in, we're happy to jump aside. I mean, I don't want to speak for the group, but Judge.me, I think, is in the category of Bitcoin as being two very powerful tools to kind of have freedom in your everyday life, to kind of go to have non-state solutions to things that are traditionally state monopolies. And Bitcoin being a currency, when we have fiat currency, when we have mandated US dollars or Australian dollars for Nintendo or wherever else you are, Judge.me, like you said, it's private arbitration. And I haven't used it myself. But it allows people at least in theory, or at least I think their mission statement, is to have a more efficient resolution of disputes, a way to kind of get justice, get people feeling equitable
right.
after some type of interaction. And I think there couldn't be anything better. I mean, if we lost funding to things like, you know, courts and stuff like that, I hope the person that started that becomes a multi-billionaire or a multi-Bitcoinaire or whatever they become.
Yeah, all of us wanted to succeed, yes.
We all wanted it to succeed, and we all want to succeed.
Yeah, I also heard we all want to secede, but it is Independence Day, so I will join you in seceding.
And I secede as well.
Yeah, sorry, not a lot of disagreement for you, Patrick. But yeah.
Well,
how about you? Have you ever used it? Oh, Nintendo. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I just wanted to jump in on that Bitcoin thing because I think I'm one of the few people who don't like Bitcoin as it stands, because it's not so much I dislike Bitcoin itself, but there's this huge emphasis on that it's an alternative to fiat currency, but ultimately it's just another way of transferring fiat currency, and I think it's important to remember that it does rely for most of its value as a commodity on its exchangeability with fiat currencies, which isn't a problem built into it per se, but it is important to remember that that's where it currently stands.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. It does give more options, but it's not money in the truest sense. It's not a commodity in its own right. It's pretty tied to.
But it's easy to evade taxes with Bitcoins. That's why I like them.
But I think we're talking about different criticisms of Bitcoin, either versus whether it's useful right now to actually spend money with it without converting to a fiat currency first, versus whether it's money in the sense of definition of...
Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was done. Go ahead.
I'm not arguing that it's not money, because I think it is money, because a service is a commodity and Bitcoin provides a service. So in that sense, it is a money. I just don't think it's a particularly sound money, and I don't think it works as a money, as a way of completely divorcing oneself from fiat currencies. I think it helps you avoid taxes and, you know, facilitates more agorism, but I think some people overplay its potential as an alternative currency.
And you just dropped the word agorism too, which I think is brilliant. Do you care to go into what agorism, you know, what it means and what it means to you?
Well, as many of our listeners, I'm sure, are aware anyway, agorism is, you could describe it as a philosophy or as an actual action of trying to live outside the state-controlled, state-regulated economy and... For various reasons, it's not something tied to any one particular political philosophy. Communists, mutualists, ANCAPs, even statists engage in it, but it's often seen as a potential way of strangling the state by avoiding taxes on transactions and facilitating more direct exchange between peoples. So, it depends where you're coming from, what you think agorism is about. But for me personally, it's just nice to be able to interact with somebody without violence entering the room in the form of the state.
And just kind of closing in with what the caller, Patrick's, topic was with judge.me is you, I guess judge, or I guess that is a, another example of agorism, right? It would kind of
absolutely
fit in that
absolutely
category.
I was just trying to a couple more examples. I mean, like, people don't realize that, you know, if you do something like pay a babysitter in cash, or, you know, go ahead and sneak drinks into a movie theater, things like that, definitely deprive, you know, the government of certain tax revenues, and that would be agorist. So, yeah, when you do things like that, most people don't even think of those things as, you know, living outside the system. It's just something that people do, especially in America. Like, you know, you just pay your babysitter in cash. You just pay the kid who mows your lawn, you know, $15 in cash. You know, there's no taxes or anything like that, but technically you're supposed to, you know, pay taxes on that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the direct exchange that a lot of people think they're engaging in day to day, and you know, yeah, in those situations, you're completely subverting this entity and keeping it out. And most people, I think, like to have that. And even those who don't share our philosophy often like that feeling of direct exchange.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick, do you have anything more to add to this? I mean, any more questions along these lines? You've been kind of quiet over there, so.
No, I mean, it's just nice to talk about this stuff with other people. I did have another question, and let me think for a second. What do you think is the greatest weakness in the voluntarist philosophy? Because whenever there's a thread on r/ANCAP about pollution, there seems to be, like, crazy amounts of comments on that. And so, like, I think, you know, pollution is one thing we really need to, like, figure out how to explain it in the simplest terms so that people aren't so averse to anarcho-capitalism.
I'll take that off the bat. I think, yeah, pollution's a big one. I certainly think that there's some still a lot of discussion over things like abortion and children, children's rights in general. I mean, that obviously has generated a lot of controversy throughout libertarian voluntarist circles. I think certainly we've made a lot of progress on those lines in the past, you know, just even the past few years, especially with a lot of the stuff that we've heard out of, you know, Stefan Molyneux and his ideas on family and children have really pushed the boundaries a little bit and helped move us along. Because Rothbard had some absolutely terrible ideas on what to do with children, and he definitely did not. And a lot of people still adhere to it too, and he did not have great ideas on children.
Wait a second, I have a question. I don't know. Did Rothbard have children anytime?
Oh, that's shit. That's a damn good question. I think he did. I read his Wikipedia article a while ago. I'm pretty sure he did. I think he had a son. That.
I'm pretty sure he's my dad.
I'm looking at it right now.
And
well, we'll move on from that for now, and Shiny can chime in and let us know.
Well,
I mean, what else do we? I mean, Ron, like, what do you think we have real big issues on?
I think that's a good point. I think pollution. I can remember. I think I even know what Patrick's referring to. There was a post on global warming, you know, and greenhouse gases and stuff like that, and even you know, our groups of ANCAPs, who are normally so confident, so assured on how to address things and what's the moral route, will just kind of tiptoe around stuff like this and be scared to handle it. You know, we won't even, it's, there's like this heresy to even questioning global warming or climate change, it's now referred to, and it puts you as this, like, it just puts you in this category, so no one even wants to go near that.
Well, it's really hard because you have to give you have to give really specific solutions to very vague problems. Like, no one really can define exactly how these problems work, specific mechanics, what, you know, who's causing them. They're really kind of these vague, lofty issues, like, you know, environmental pollution, global warming, and those things, they're just very dispersed and kind of cloudy, and you have to give really specific, you know, people want to see specifics. They want to hear exactly what your solutions are. They want to talk about, you know, scientific solutions and exact numbers. And, like, we don't know what the heck the solutions are going to be to that level of specificity. We just know that, they're not going to be government run. It's a really kind of a crappy answer.
Well,
I think.
I don't think it's a crappy answer. Let me put it in a different way. This is what I tell people when they have many questions, which, by the way, are valid questions, and I'm absolutely entertaining them. I just preface every answer with the following. I ask him, well, do you know how a pencil is made? Right? And the answer is going to be no. He doesn't know how a pencil is made. Nobody knows how to make a pencil from the very beginning, right? Because it's impossible. A pencil involves thousands of human beings, involves thousands and thousands of tons of prime matter. It needs to be shuffled from its original spot into the factory. And it actually involves several factories. You don't buy dirt and wood, and with that you make, you know, a pencil. That's not how it works. And so I tell them, all right, so you don't know how pencils are made, but pencils are still made, and we don't have a committee or a Soviet of pencil making, do we? And then he says, well, all right, okay, so my answer is going to be in the same vein. I don't exactly know how this would work, but this is how I suggest could possibly work. And if it doesn't work, I would like you to help me figure out a better way, right? I think that works very well in most conversations with most people. People actually take that very well.
Yeah, that sounds good. Just to register my agreement, I think definitely pollution is... it's not a hard issue in the theoretical, abstract kind of world, but when you take it into the real world, it becomes a little more complicated. Recently, I was, you know, confident, ANCAP, whatever, running through a debate, and somebody brought up ozone and CFCs, and I didn't really have an answer that I was satisfied with to the problem, which of course doesn't invalidate anything about the philosophy, but it did trip me up.
And what you're talking about are CFCs. You're referring to chlorofluorocarbons, which at least for a while it's something that's in refrigerators. It's stuff that was thought to, you know, deteriorate or create holes in the ozone. So there was a measured hole in the ozone, and it was theorized that that's what's breaking it up. And then ozone, I think, is this instead of, we're used to thinking about oxygen as O2. If I remember correctly, I think it's O3. You know, it's up there, higher up in the atmosphere. And from the thread, though, our caller, what Patrick was talking to, I saw somebody linked a study saying that, and I could be wrong, that that was kind of not confirmed. There was an observed hole in the ozone, but it wasn't CFC. That wasn't confirmed, or later research has said that. And that was another one of those things that's kind of been, you know, before climate change, that was another, you know, environmental threat that was discussed a lot.
I don't think we can really confirm or deny whether the hole in the ozone was caused or partly caused by CFCs, but we do have evidence that the chlorine radicals that come off CFCs do degrade ozone.
I think as far as the problem with explaining how to fix a problem with like that, though, even if CFCs aren't responsible for ozone degradation, those situations do exist in other fields, and they're one of the harder ones. I mean, I ended up resorting to, like, if people wanted to, they could pump ozone into the atmosphere, which isn't necessarily wrong, but it's a bit of a weak argument.
Yeah, my thing is that, of course, you know, I kind of throw the cop-out argument that, when things get really complicated and you get into nitty-gritty, you know, science and specifics and how things work, I'm like, I just take a step back. I'm like, okay, you know, let's just take a step back, and we have two ways of doing things. You could do it voluntarily, or you could do it involuntarily. You can force people to do things, or you cannot. You know, which one do you think is better? Yeah, and a lot of people, you know, they'll resort to that. But we need to force people to do things because they just won't get on board. And I like to, you know, step back and tell them, you know, well, what makes it such that, you know, all these people across the world are talking about these big problems. They're talking about pollution. They're worried about, you know, these big issues. If everybody's bringing up these points over and over and over again, isn't it such a case that enough people are probably going to be concerned about it that it'll just get done voluntarily? Like, people yeah. are really, really super concerned about a lot of these things with good reason, and therefore they're probably going to get solved.
Yeah, I mean, I've used that one a few times on not necessarily stuff like the CFCs or even global warming, but it is a good point. You know, people go around saying, you know, oh, people won't do this unless we force them to. And you're like, well, I've never met a person who didn't think this needed to get done. So is there really such a big problem there?
And the thing, I guess, what Patrick's probably referring to, or maybe not referring to, but one of the reasons that is that it's really hard to define or own the air, or define the air as something that's privately owned. So our notions, our normal notions of property rights and protection, it gets kind of muggy. But you know what Eternal's saying is that, you know, even that being said, even though it might be trickier conceptually or in action even, it's still better solved without aggression, right? Rather than having these agreements where Al Gore flies around and tells us, you know, how much we're going to reduce things or sells carbon credits. You know, as long as it's not monopoly controlled and it's nonviolent solutions, it you would think it really shouldn't be that hard in the end.
Let me think about something. Why is it that we find it easy to define air as private property when it's in a bottle, but not when it's out in the open air? And I'm gonna ask, you know, excuse me for the pun. Why, right?
Well, I mean, obviously, there's the obvious answer to that. It's easier to keep track of in a bottle, so you can actually, you know, that easily prove that, okay, well, these particular, you know, air molecules belong to me. Whereas, you know, as soon as something's taken off on the wind current within a few feet, it already becomes kind of hard to ascertain what's owned by you and what's not.
Yes, exactly. It's like saying, how come it becomes hard to determine which is your water once you've dumped it into the ocean?
Yeah, it's the exact same problem. And I don't think that's a bad thing, because, you know, we'd all be having, you know, property claims against us for the air we're breathing, since somebody else has expelled it from their lungs before us, if you could, you know, keep track of that stuff. So it's not necessarily a bad thing in my books.
Well, I think that, I mean, it's definitely a topic that's worth discussing further. As Patrick suggested, it's something we haven't completely solved. So we can talk about this on future shows. And certainly if you guys, you listeners, want to call in about this and your thoughts and ideas, you can call in to our Skype at Decline to State. That's one word, Decline to State. And, you know, we can definitely, you know, discuss this further at another show. But I kind of wanted to move on to something a little different. So, you know, I know, Reto, you had something that you wanted to bring up. Ron, you wanted to bring this up, actually. So,
yeah, I think it was something that was brought up at first by Patrick, and we all kind of wanted to discuss it. So it's good that it came up. But, you know, another difficult topic for people of our liberty mindset, and because it's difficult, it probably means it's worth talking about, is spanking. And I know, you know, we were talking about rights of children and stuff like that. For me, I'm interested still, and I don't think I have all the answers myself, where that line is, where parenting becomes aggression, or where the rights of children get violated. I think, you know, there's a fairly good consensus that spanking or hitting kids or using violence is, you know, not only not a good way to parent, but also it could be, you know, a violation of the ethics that we're kind of going by. But, you know, at some point, like, you want to vaccinate your kids and they don't want to get a needle in them and you try to convince them into it. There arguably is a gray area, and I guess I'm curious where that is. Where do you guys kind of make that distinction? I mean, pulling a kid away from a road with cars and, you know, grabbing them by the arm and making sure they get back fast enough, you know, that's probably not going to be considered an act of aggression. But after the fact punishment for, you know, watching too much TV, you know, that would be. But where is that line? Where is that distinction made? And if you guys could help me flesh that out, I would much appreciate it.
Well, I want to make a point first. I think there's a very... Okay, never mind.
I've been thinking about something. First thing I can say is that the state will tell you right away that the line that means kids have rights is pretty much when they're 18, because everybody knows that, because it's in the law, and the law is the absolute source of ultimate truth, right? However, I would say that there's a way that you can figure out when and where it's appropriate to use force against a child. And it's actually not very much dissimilar to when and where force is allowed to be used against a person who is a grown-up, right? An adult. And that is, in my view, when that force is actually... But that force is actually justified by way of having you suppose that consent is going to be granted otherwise, right? I think Shiny wants to intervene with her views, and I'd love to hear that.
I think the question that Ronald McPaul posed is, in a way, the wrong question. I think there's kind of a guideline that we're forgetting, that spanking is a form of punishment. It's done as, you know, an act of force toward a child because you maybe want to, quote, teach them a lesson, or because you think they deserve something bad done to them for what they've done. There's a important distinction between acting with force to punish a child versus acting with force in the child's interest. And while that's not a perfect delineation between which acts are okay and which of them constitute aggression, it at least is a good rule of thumb that clears up the issue a lot, or deconflates, I don't think that's a word, deconflates these two issues.
We can use it. I think you explained that pretty well. And also it sounds, I guess, kind of continue your thought, that kind of helps me understand. And I think you're getting at the notion of what's like of justice, right? And justice is a subjective word. And it might not perfectly apply to parenting or to kids, but that's kind of what I'm thinking of now.
I think it applies to Batman, though.
It certainly applies to Batman. I'm going to have the bat signal up today for 4th of July. But there's like a retribution, and it seems like you're indicating that the part where it's something after the fact, this retributive, you know, repercussions or justice, to admonish a kid or something like that, that's where it becomes unethical. That's the part that kind of seems unnecessary, and maybe more as, you know, true proponents of liberty or people trying to advocate this nonviolent society and way of life, you know, where you go after the fact is where it becomes a problem. Is that kind of the direction you're taking me, Shiny? Is that... I know I'm using different words to you know, different terms to describe what you said, but
sorry, we have a caller, I think.
Oh, we do. Is it on?
Yeah, let's welcome John Norris to the show.
Hey, John, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. Good evening, everybody. Happy 4th.
Happy 4th.
You too. Yeah, we can hear you.
I
good.
Think I'm going to start by saying hello.
No, we can hear you.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I...
Go ahead.
All right, I am a statist. I do believe there needs to be an existence of the state. And I think one thing I have, one problem I have reconciling with your philosophy is I think that absent a legitimate monopoly of legitimate force, at least in terms of the enforcement of contracts and settling disputes, I think that it will always eventually go to the highest bidder, or it might will make right. What do you have to say to that?
Well, I certainly think that there's a distinction that you haven't made when you say something like it will go to the highest bidder. Well, what's happening now with our government? I mean, who's in charge of the actual regulation? Who's in charge of the government? Well, who's getting all the money and the benefits? Look at what just happened with the banks. I mean, the banks, Goldman Sachs, are giving tons of money to government now, and they got an enormous bailout. They're getting trillions of dollars of loans. So,
I agree. I mean, by no means is the current state of government ideal. There needs to be a gross limitation and extreme reforms to limit the powers of not only governments but the lobbies that eventually buy the government. And needs to be, habitual reformation over the course of 20 years or so. But I'm saying in a society that does not have any police force, the enforcement of contracts basically becomes almost impossible.
Well, I think you're wrong if you think there's not a police force. There's certainly not a monopoly peace force, but I mean,
are you suggesting
private security?
Well, I mean, the private security, who employs the private security?
The property owners who want to defend their property.
Wouldn't that eventually lead to the private security eventually going to the highest bidder? Whoever had more money could buy the private security and simply enforce the contracts at their will.
Well, I mean, think about it like this. You have varying, for instance, bread. When the market provides bread, you have the bread that's marketed to the rich, and you have the bread that's marketed more towards the poor. One's cheaper and generally thought of as lesser in quality or lesser in bells and whistles, but it's still bread. It's still pretty good. And then you have organic whole grain olive bread that's sold to the rich. So the market covers just about every base as far as that's concerned.
I understand that analogy, but I think there's a bit of a disconnect. With bread, you only need enough to get yourself full, but if you're having a contract dispute, you buy enough security so that you have so much more than the other person. If you have enough money to do that, you can buy more security than the other person and eventually win any argument that you need to.
Are you sure that's not what happens already with the state? Because I am pretty sure it does.
I don't advocate the state in its current form. I'm saying that in a society without any state, it would be, without the legitimate monopoly of force.
I mean, how do you know that? Because you can advocate for an ideal state, but you have a current state, right? And so you're talking, you're comparing two ideal situations, the ideal situation that you have imagined about an ideal state, and then a situation that we're all trying to get to, which is a stateless society. And how do you know, how do you make this comparison? What facts do you have to make this comparison, right?
I mean, I'm just saying in theory, I'm not pretending to say that I'm thinking of an ideal state. Obviously, any state will have flaws and it needs to be constantly reformed, and there needs to be this, the public has to be vigilant. However, what we're talking about here on your radio show is the benefits and the plausibility of an anarcho-capitalist society in which there is no police force, and police forces will be private security firms which will be paid for, which will be willing to offer their services to the highest bidder. I mean, the burden of proof, I believe, in this argument is on you.
Well, here's the real trick is, let's say there's a really well-played, expensive police force that the rich buy up, and, they charge a lot of money, and they get a lot of money from the rich to enforce their contracts and stuff. They still won't, first and foremost, they still are not going to necessarily have the most money just because they, are getting their funding from the rich. I mean, look at things like Walmart and all those retail consumers. The products that are sold out to the masses. I mean, Walmart makes a fortune selling a product to people who don't have money. I mean, it is dirt poor people to shop at Walmart, and Walmart has made billions of dollars. So clearly, there's definitely money there. It's definitely possible for poor people to pull their resources together and you know, have reasonable representation. I think another thing that we really need to talk about is that, of course, you know, how does, when you're talking about conflict resolution, when you're talking about police, you're talking about, you know, the concern that, that people have, you know, when they're introduced the ideas of, you know, competing systems of law and you know, polycentric law and the whole idea of what we're talking about with voluntarism is, you know, how the heck do we prevent people from just going into all out like gang warfare with each other? How do you keep people from how do you keep it from devolving into the violent conflict when, you know, you have a bunch of people who have a lot of power and a bunch of people who, you know, who don't have a lot of have money or power? And the real thing it comes down to is violent conflict is really, really expensive. It's really not good business. And it, the real trick is, you know, how do states fund that kind of, you know, violent conflict?
I mean, I wasn't exactly – I came here specifically to address, for instance, contract laws. Let's say there's a land dispute. And let's say that you have, you and I have adjoining land, and then there's like a river in the middle, and we both claim to have ownership of the river. Now, obviously, if you want to resolve this complaint, it would go to, I mean, there's no courts, there's no police to arbitrate, and there's no police. Well, there's no police to enforce the will of the courts. It would be whomever had the better police force could simply do whatever they want. It would be like Andrew Jackson and the Indians all over again, simply ignoring the courts.
Well, it wouldn't be as simple as that. It's all about contracts. It's all about insurance. What it is, you know, we do have courts, which we call dispute resolution organizations, you know, DROs for short. These guys, you know, they make their judgments. They're decided upon by both parties is something that is fair to both parties. You know, people don't want to go to a dispute resolution organization that will, you know, weigh in their incorrect fashion, you know, be biased. I think Nick kind of wanted to kind of finish up what I was saying here. Do you want to jump in here? Because you've been kind of biting at the bit here.
I certainly do. There's one point that I really want to make, and it comes back to what you were saying with the fact that violent coercion is a very expensive thing to do. The fact of the matter is, just because you have the, you know, greatest military force, the greatest, you know, private security company, does not mean that it's in your best interests to get into violent conflict with another one, because the fact is violent conflict is expensive, and so for it to even be worth your while, there has to be a sufficient gain for the amount of resources you're going to expend. This is exactly why we don't see extremely hostile countries, which may actually have a significantly better military force, attacking smaller countries that, you know, they'd like to control, but the fact is the benefits just wouldn't outweigh the costs of doing it. And when you talk about how the rich will dominate all the poor with their private security company, because, you know, the private security company has more resources to expend. The fact is the poor don't have much resources worth taking, and any conflict with them is going to be expensive. So the poorer somebody is, the less benefit there is in entering violent conflict with them. And I think relative to how fast that benefit decreases, there's a lot slower decrease in ability to resist. You know, all you really need to resist violently and kill a few people is a single AK-47, and you can do a lot of damage to somebody who's trying to, you know, attack you and your property. So the risks associated with violent incursion on somebody's property don't decrease proportional to the amount of gain you can get from that. So I think that's a very important thing to remember.
I mean, that's a valid point and everything. There are times when it is not worth it to get into violent coercion over a dispute of, like, say, land or property. However, there are times where it is worth the cost of the violent coercion to get into a land dispute. I mean, let's go back to my example of you and I having a land dispute, let's say over a river. But let's say I also have a gold mine on my property, and I use my gold mine, and I go to the courts, and even if the courts find in your favor, what's to stop me from enforcing my will with my better police force? And not only do I now have the river, I have all the wealth and property associated with it. I have the water to irrigate my crops. I have the fish and everything. I've gained something that's worth the violent incursion.
Well,
what's to stop? It's reputation. It has to do with insurance. I mean, what happens is, you know, if you're going to go bully people around, people are going to obviously know that you're a bully. And what's going to happen is your rating, it's like a credit score. I mean, your rating is going to go down, and so you won't be able to enter into contracts with other people. I mean, you certainly still need to be able to sell things. You need to acquire the services of banks, of all sorts of other people, to be able to move products. I mean, even if you have a whole bunch of resources, you still need other people. You simply can't have true vertical integration of everything you need. So you need to be able to enter in contracts with other people. Well, if you go ahead and bully people around all the time, and you kick them off their land with guns, and you take their resources, well, no one's going to want to do business with you. Everyone's going to want to stay the heck away.
I've heard that argument before, but I have a hard time believing it, because I think that at some point, if you have enough money, the forces of the market will, even if somebody has a bad enough reputation, not only will they be able to, you know, still get business because there will be profit in it, because eventually the market will gravitate towards store profit, at least some point will take my money no matter how bad my reputation is, but also I can use my money to influence the reputation bureau. I can use it to influence the insurance bureau. And if not, you know, again, I could use force to manipulate them.
Hmm. All right. So it sounds to me, John's your name, right?
Yes, sir.
Hey. Well, by the way, I didn't say this before, but, you know, thank you for calling. We love to have you here. This is a very interesting conversation. And now I'd like to ask you a question, right? It sounds to me like everything that you posit is possible against a reputation agency or a private defense force is also possible against any state.
Most definitely.
Correct.
I think so, at some point the state there needs to be limits on lobbying, and, you know, eventually, like,
but, wait a second,
Jefferson, the tree. Go ahead.
How's that going to happen, right? I mean,
well, as Jefferson put it, the tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots. What is, I don't know the exact quote, but there needs to be.
Okay, but you're talking about mass violence to impose a certain system, right? And I think you and me both agree that we'd like to avoid that for as long as possible, because it's not necessarily a good thing, right?
I would love to avoid it. But I also think that equal protection under the law is more valuable than, you know, what is it? Those value safety over liberty deserve neither.
Yeah, we do agree with that. We definitely agree on that. The question is, if you propose that a reputation agency or a defense agency are vulnerable to this kind of they're subject to this vulnerability, then. It's pretty clear that any organization, even a government, is also going to be vulnerable to this. So I'd like to know if you have a strategy to prevent that in a government.
I don't see any unique strategy. I mean, no comprehensive specific strategy right now to prevent that in the government. But I will say this. In two competing paradigms, the government or the anarcho-capitalist society, where they are both subject to corruption and things, I will always go with the one that provides the official monopoly of force and at least some chance of equal protection under the law, and not this, you know, being sold to the highest bidder.
How do you know that?
Because, I mean, I don't – what do you mean? How do I know it won't happen? In fact, I think it actually will happen. But I think officially, at least on paper, and there needs to be, I think, a system at least with some recourse and some vast limits on the government – to prevent it from being bought and sold like it is today.
Correct. But, so how would you go about making that? That's basically my question, right?
I mean, obviously it would be started at a campaign level. I think politicians are influenced too much by money. We would have to limit campaign donations.
You're talking about creating a new system. So you can't refer on the you can't piggyback on the current system, because the current system clearly cannot be modified. I mean, I
disagree that I can't piggyback on the current system. I think that, I mean, you create an entire new system. There's no brand new system. It will always be derivative.
Wait a second.
You know,
I have to ask you a question. Did the U.S. government come about by piggybacking on the British government? This is, I think, a valid question because you think so?
How? I think there's the legislature. The initial power was in the legislature, as it is in the British system. I think they're both very, very derivative of Locke.
No, wait a second. We're talking about two different systems of government, right? We're talking about a monarchy that was in Britain, and then the U.S. government, which is at least in name a Republican system of government.
I disagree that the British at that time were an absolute monarchy. They weren't. Parliament was quite powerful.
Even if they weren't, even if they were just in name a monarchy or a parliamentary monarchy or whatever they were, the U.S. government wasn't created by relying on affordances that the British government did, right?
It wasn't entirely on the British government, in fact, but it borrows from other theories, especially, you know, it borrows heavily from Locke, Montesquieu. Madison had his own ideas, and basically he was next in a long line of philosophers.
That doesn't answer my question, right? My question was, do you think you can create a system piggybacking on the same existing system that was before? And you're talking about piggybacking on ideas, and you're talking about piggybacking on important discoveries that many political philosophers made, but that doesn't mean that doesn't translate to piggybacking on the existing system, right? The U.S. government wasn't created by the British Crown, was it?
No, it was created mostly by James Madison and John Jay and Alexander Hamilton. And obviously, Jefferson argued, you know, his beliefs there too. And I think there are good points in every one of those men's beliefs. And I think that a group of educated, elected individuals could come together and drawing upon not only those four men, but Locke and Montesquieu and even Aristotle. And you could come up with a better system of government than what we have today. And eventually, when that got tired, we could get together and come together with a new one. Yes, sir? I'm sorry.
All right.
What was last? Sorry,
you kind of dropped out a little bit there.
I apologize.
It's my computer. My computer always has this problem.
Okay. What was the last thing you heard?
Hey, John Norris. This is Ronald McPaul. I haven't chimed in yet. I guess Rutto, who you were just talking with, kind of dropped out for a second. But I know, and you know, it's brave of you to jump in this situation. You kind of like multiple people debate, and you got differing views and. I just want to say, you know, again, thanks for calling in, and I think you come from the same place a lot of us do. I mean, what you're talking about is people, ultimately people with, you know, this monopoly on power, this huge disproportionate amount of power in their favor, being able to muscle that around. And that's, you know, whether or not we agree about kind of how to best address that, I think we all kind of agree that we're trying to avoid that. You know,
yes.
We happen to think that, you know, a state-granted monopoly is kind of going to make that situation worse. I think it might be fair to say that your view, at least in part, is that someone with a lot of money or with more power would have that more. But we can definitely see where you're coming from, and I think it's coming from a good place. It's a valid concern. Somebody in our chat just brought up that, you know, I think an influential book for a lot of us has been The Machinery of Freedom, written by Mr. Fried, you kind of, I mean, not that it'll change your mind or you'll come to our views, but that's just one thing we wanted to plug that kind of guides our understanding of what, you know, of kind of why our point of view is better for, you know, at least in our minds, for kind of limiting those abuses and clean, you know, and making that more just society, which all of us want. And you know, we're certainly, you know, certainly appreciate you coming on with a disagreeing view, and I want to thank you again for calling.
I was going to chime in and recommend another book for both you and our listeners in general. Chaos Theory by Bob Murphy is a fantastic read, and it covers a lot of these common objections to polycentric law, and I think it's probably better than anything we can say here on air. I mean, the arguments are fantastic.
Yeah, and
you can check that stuff for free. You can get all the stuff for free at www.mises.org. That's www.mises.org. And if you search for them, they have all these things for free on that site. PDFs, or actually, they might even have audio. I think they have a free audiobook for Chaos Theory. They definitely do.
Yeah.
I don't know if they have it for Machinery of Freedom.
And And not to pawn you off on the book, but I mean, and it's been a great discussion. And I just wanted to say finally, you know, before we end that, it'd be lovely to have you call in again, because, you know, you're an articulate person, and I think it's a good discussion.
I mean, we're going to have to agree.
Can you call us next week? I'd love to hear you more.
Right. I think at this point we're going to have to agree to disagree, and I will go to, Murphy and Friedman. I guess I can read those books, maybe in a couple of weeks I'll see what they have to say, and then we can come together and we can reference them. You know, maybe I can see how I can reconcile my beliefs with them, or how you can reconcile their beliefs with them. And we can have an even more continuance of this debate, because it is a major stopping point. You need to guarantee equal protection under the law in a just society.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think the goal is justice, and I think we have a similar goal, and just maybe different views on just the logistics of how to get there. But yeah, absolutely. If at any time you want to call in, we'd love to have you, because you've been a great caller.
I just want to end on one last thing. I think probably all of us have asked the same questions you're asking now. We've all been there. I was a skeptic just like you. I mean, the exact same questions, the exact same feelings, and it takes some time to process all the information, to learn everything. So, you know, just because, you know, you aren't, you know, with us right now, and we didn't convert you in one, you know, quick 15-minute call.
Or vice versa,
that doesn't mean anything. Yeah, that doesn't mean anything.
He could have pushed us all to his view. I mean, we're open to that too.
Well, certainly, but I mean, it doesn't mean anything either way. It's definitely a deep topic. There's a lot of depth to it, and
We'd have to rename the show if that happened, right?
Oh, damn.
Declined state, except in the given exceptional times.
It would be declined to most of the state.
Well, and then John Norris would have the right to claim that he was the inception of that.
Hey, that's absolutely fair. John, I hope you had a great day today, and I hope you have the rest of the day great as well. I hope you go out and, you know, enjoy the deep fry stuff and blow stuff up.
I've been doing that all day. I mean, I'm a little bit drunk right now. So,
hey, good to hear it.
We're all a little bit drunk here, so don't worry about it.
All right, everybody. You
man,
guys have a great
I hope it's great talking to you.
All right.
Have a great day, man.
All right, yeah. We got another, 8 minutes left in the show. I think we're going to try to wrap it up at 11:30. So, there's one thing that, I guess, Ron, you wanted to talk about. There was something related to autonomous vehicles.
Oh yeah, we got jumped around, and we got interrupted a little bit on the spanking topic and the debate topic by callers, but it's been fine. If you guys want, we can go to the last one just to kind of clean things up. Is we were talking about on the r/declinedestate at Reddit. I submitted the topic about driverless vehicles or the Google car. There was a 4-minute TED talk, and I guess from our point of view, that caller reminds us that, you know, he's called himself a statist. He would disagree, but I think from our point of view, that it seems like as a society we kind of have the blinders on. There's this idea that we would want to replace all drivers with AI before we even consider firing the road provider, which is to say, you know, the state, consistent with our show title, Decline the State. It seems to me that it's just hard to register. It's like when you, I can't think of a good analogy, but it's like, oh, I guess it would be the one that I hear recently is that the fish doesn't know what water is. The fish is not aware of it because it's everywhere. It's kind of the same thing for us in a statist or a state society to think, well, all these people are getting into accidents. There's 40,000 deaths a year on public roads. And I guess the only way to fix it is to stop drunk driving and to get AI drivers and to not ever look at these dangerous hairpin turns or you know, specific traffic intersections with have high death rates and stuff like that. I don't know if any of you guys feel the same way, but I get immensely frustrated driving in traffic and being like, there's got to be a better way. How come nobody, I mean, people blame their fellow drivers, people blame rush hour, but they don't say, hey, look, maybe there could be a little bit more throughput on this road. Maybe it could be designed better, maybe a better traffic signal system. Maybe, you know, these cars could be automatically driven easier. Anybody want to weigh in? I know we don't have a lot of time for this topic.
Yeah, sure. I'll quickly weigh in with a little something-something. Yeah, it's something I think is interesting when, you know, the classic argument of who will provide roads comes up. And, I mean, the fact is that, sure, the government provides roads, but, I mean, they're of an abysmal quality, really. You know, you got potholing everywhere, especially around here. It takes them, you know, months to fill in a few potholes around here. I remember a single repair on a bridge took about 8 months, and this bridge was tiny to begin with, and with, you know, barriers erected. I mean, it was like a serious hazard. Every morning when I was on the bus, I was, you know, holding my breath, waiting to die from falling off this freaking bridge. Like, it was scary, and it just sat there most of the time with nobody working on it for 8 months.
I've had the same experience. You wouldn't believe it, Nintendo, in, you know, my town in California.
I believe it.
And isn't it, I guess, and do you share this feeling? It's so frustrating to me just to see. It's this direct comparison. I mean, at least to me, and this is my point of view, you know, Ronald McPaul, but it's, you see the vehicles, they get more efficient, there's better gas mileage, they're safer, there's more airbags, there's better testing, it gets more reliable, cars last, you know, from Japan over 200,000 miles, you know, it's arguably more stylish, we get dubs, we get new rims, you know, for the navigation, we go from AAA maps to MapQuest printouts, we've gone to TomTom GPS, we got voice navigation, and now we all have that on our phone, but with the roads themselves, it stays the same. There's 40,000 deaths a couple years ago. The year after that, 40,000 deaths. This year, it's going to be 40,000 deaths. Next year, you can count on it, about 40,000 deaths. It's pretty consistent. This is not a Darwin Awards thing. It's pulling from, you know, the best and the brightest, as well as it is from the, you know, the less desirable portion of society. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason to it, and it's not looked at. And just, again, you know, one of the things that pains me, and I know we're wrapping up time for the show, I guess if nobody else wants to chime in, maybe we'll kind of head over to closing arguments.
Oh, I would just weigh in just a little bit on the whole thing. I think that you touched on, you know, of course, the massive loss of life that's caused on our roadways by just, you know, bad driving, you know, driving in hazardous conditions, all sorts of things. A lot of it, you know, drunk driving crash is a big thing too. And all these things can be negated, if not, you know, completely eliminated through autonomous vehicles in general. It's certainly something which can just change the landscape of the way we commute. And the idea that, you know, we don't have to worry about, you know, drivers being distracted on the road because, you know, computers don't get distracted. That's something that would save billions of dollars a year. But certainly, the only people I think that would not like it maybe are, like, the car manufacturers themselves, because now they don't get all these wrecked cars that need replacements.
and I should say too, I mean, you make a good point. Like, I'm totally for these driverless solutions. I would love to get other stuff done while the car is driving itself. And I'm only taking exception to the fact that we don't ever even look at the roads. It's not a consideration. But I mean, improvements on all fronts would be fantastic. But just the fact that the roads part just seems to be ignored is just, it's kind of a WTF moment for me.
Well, to be fair, I have been cheated out of the future that I was promised when I was a kid. We have no floating hoverboards. We have no flying cars. And I'm just waiting until Google's technology for, you know, driverless or self-driving cars comes out. Apparently, it's a thing that is a question of insurance, mostly. I mean, you know, who's going to be responsible for a crash? As for me, I'm already prepared. I have a black Trans Am with bowling ball hubcaps. And I'm just waiting till the day I can push auto cruise on the dash and then go anywhere I want party on and then come back home safely without having to drive drunk. I'm really waiting for that day, and man, my childhood lied to me, but I'm pretty positive and confident that at some point we're going to get there.
A lot of broken hearts. A lot of broken hearts from all those lies, I gotta say.
I think you're referring to the Back to the Future movie, the time referenced in the movie the time that the movie took place that were hoverboards in. Then it was the future. It's since come and passed. I forget the exact date.
And of course, the ever-present TV show of the 80s of the talking self-driving car, which we're still waiting for. My car already talks, thanks to Android, but it doesn't drive itself. It's really sad.
Knight Rider, right? That's the name of the show. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Oh, there we go. I'm a ditz too for
now. Before my time by a little bit.
Oh,
get stuff on TV Land or something.
Dear Rutto, we're old. It's happened. It's officially been observed.
Yeah, that's before my time.
That's rough.
So Rutto and I are the old people here. Missed out. You guys
being
outed.
Oh, I think we're kind of out of time here, so let's wrap this up. It's great having everybody on. I think we had a good time tonight. Had some good callers. Happy 4th to everybody, our listeners, and you guys as well, of course.
Happy Independence Day, guys. Happy Independence Day. I hope you have a great day, and I hope we can see each other here next week, and everybody will have the same great time that I had today.
Mm-hmm. And you guys can check us out at our main website. That's declinefm.com. That's declinefm.com. You can check us out. There's a live chat there. You can participate in the chat during our shows. We also have our archive available there, so you can download our shows at any time and listen to them. For our live shows, of course, you can call and discuss. You also can check us out on our Reddit page and suggest content. You go to www.reddit.com/r/decline2state, and you'll be able to suggest articles and links to other sites and conversations you've had on Reddit or elsewhere that you think are interesting. Whatever content you want, if it gets to the top of the list, we'll talk about it.
Agreed. And I want to just reiterate, too, that Decline to State is brought to you commercial-free. Decline to State is a group effort motivated by our love of the message of liberty, as well as bow ties and monocles, as capitalists. And this is Ron McPault saying, remember, when asked, always decline to state.
All right, this is Eternal signing off.
This is Nintendo signing off on not our Independence Day because we still belong to the Commonwealth.
This is Rotto here, and I hope you have a fantastic day. Thanks for sticking with us. Have a great day.
And I'm still shiny. Some things never change. Have a happy Overthrow the Government Day and blow some stuff up.
Chicka chicka wow, chicka wow, outro. Chicka chicka.